hppodcraft.com.
I believe that none of you children would have hesitated for an instant to follow the good, honest Nutcracker, who could never have meditated any evil. Maria consented to follow him so much the more readily because she knew what claim she had upon his gratitude, and because she was convinced that he would keep his word and show her many beautiful things. "I will go with you, Master Drosselmeyer," she said, "but it must not be far, and it must not be long, for as yet I have hardly had any sleep." "I will choose then," replied Nutcracker, "the nearest, though a more difficult way." He went onward, and Maria followed him, until he stopped before a large antique wardrobe which stood in the hall. Maria perceived, to her astonishment, that the doors of this wardrobe, which were always kept locked, now stood wide open, so that she could see her father's fox-furred traveling coat, which hung in front. Nutcracker clambered very nimbly up by the carved figures and ornaments until he could grasp the large tassel which hung down the back of the coat and was fastened to it by a thick cord. As soon as Nutcracker pulled upon the tassel, a neat little stairs of cedar wood stretched down from the sleeve of the traveling coat to the floor. "Ascend, if you please, dearest miss," cried Nutcracker. Maria did so. But scarcely had she gone up the sleeve, scarcely had she seen her way out at the collar, when a dazzling light broke forth upon her, and all at once she stood upon a sweet-smelling meadow, surrounded by millions of sparks, which darted up like flashing jewels. We are now upon Candy Meadow.
What did I just hear? That is insanity!
Quietly hallucinating, watching Candy dance all night.
Well, I like that song.
That's a song about this fourth chapter we're about to discuss here on Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. Thank you for joining us around the fireplace here at Patreon. This is the conclusion of our coverage of The Nutcracker and the Mouse King by E.T.A. Hoffman.
That fella over there in the classy leather chair is Andrew Lehman. The book open on his lap, bunny slippers and red fez bedecked. Don't forget to start the new year right by grabbing all of the merchandise at hplhs.org. That's the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society. Synopsor! What happened in the story so far? Yes.
I'll get us up to speed and I'll try to keep it to the essentials. Maria is a little girl who believes the Nutcracker is the cursed nephew of the watchmaker Drosselmeyer. After the nephew saved the cursed Princess Perlipat, he was cast out of Nuremberg. He was cursed himself. He took on the princess's curse. The only thing that will end his curse is defeating the seven-headed Mouse King, which he has just done, and to be loved by a princess for who he is and not how he looks.
Classic setup. Yes. Hero enters covered in mouse entrails. Start of every great story.
At this point, I feel like everything that has happened has been due to the dreams of this girl. That is not real. Drosselmeyer told her all this stuff and she bought it, but folks aren't believing her because it's crazy, obviously. But now the Nutcracker has come to life again and is leading her into a closet, up some stairs that go into her dad's robe's sleeve.
Yeah.
She crawls up the sleeve and then pops out of the top and is now in a magical candy land.
I thought, in my head from my first read, I thought they open the wardrobe and go in. I forgot about that little detail that they walk up the wizard sleeve of dad's coat. That's so great.
He pulls the belt, the rope on the belt, and then out from the sleeve drops some stairs. And then she goes up the stairs to the sleeve. Size and proportions are damned here.
That's right. It's great. That's little kid thinking. It's little kid dreamlike thinking.
I don't know what little kids you're hanging out with, but my kids, that's the first thing I go, how would she fit in a sleeve? That doesn't make any sense. My kids rip apart everything. Like they love doing that. Like anything doesn't make sense.
That's going to come in real handy when a little fairy appears on your desk and it starts talking to you about how he's going to kidnap your wife and stuff. You're going to be grateful that your kids are that way. So they're going to come in and smash the fairy. But keep in mind, the Nutcracker's still ugly at this point when he takes her around. He's come to life, but he's flexing like the Nutcracker. You're talking about he takes her to Candyland, and I go, I wonder if Candyland the board game is based on this. It's not, or at least not admittedly based on this, but it was created in 1948 by Eleanor Abbott while she was recovering from polio in San Diego. Did you play that when you were a kid? I did.
Oh, yeah, of course.
It was made for and tested by the children in the same wards on the hospital where she was. So the kids in the hospital tested it out, and they suggested she submit it to Milton Bradley. Or that's what it said in the Wikipedia entry. I feel like it's probably the one kid that carries a briefcase around who probably suggested that. Like, I've got a business idea for you, ma'am. But that just tells you kids want to see Candy dance around. It worked for me back then when I played the game. I thought a lot about this section of the book. I kind of didn't expect that it would be in here. We made a joke in the first episode that this would literally be the ballet, and it kind of is. People just dancing around and looking at these lands. It's sort of a reward section. The whole last fourth of this book is literally all sugar.
Yeah.
And
well, if you're a kid, dude, my kids are all about sweets. That's all they ever think about.
Yeah.
And when they're going to get their next fix. Like, it's video games and sweets. That's all it's about. So this would be primo for them.
In an interesting way, this book mirrors real experience in that many of us go fight battles all day. And those battles are insane. Oftentimes it's like discussing whether we should buy a mop with some middle manager. You know, you kill that day's mouse king. It sure makes no sense. And you get home and you want that happy ending, which is to be relieved of these burdens, these obstacles mm-hmm. you've had to confront. Go to work, fight the battles. You come home, you want to watch TV and escape or play video games, have a drink, pour some sake out in the sink, whatever you enjoy.
Yeah.
There's a basic programming drive in the brain, the story of the hero who deals with all the hard things, and then there's a reward for it. But it's a really dangerous thing for an artist to describe because it might disappoint. People might not get interested, or they might lose interest. Which is why fairy tales dispatch it with one sentence. They lived happily ever after. No time is spent on the happy part.
Well, because everybody's idea of what happy is different. And if you just say they're happy, and then that leaves it open for me to think of the things that I would like to do if I was in their situation.
If you track back 5 to 10 minutes from the end of a movie, the main characters are always very unhappy. It's kind of an odd thing to think about. You like these people so much, but you spend the whole time watching them suffer. At the end, they get a kiss. Maybe they drive into the sunset. Lando Calrissian dances a little bit in the group photo. There's trepidation on the part, as you say, about showing too much. But E.T.A. Hoffman is confident. He's like, let's have a look at this. I thought about it. Why does this resonate in particular with Christmas? It's set around then.
Yeah.
But there's something in the story that's Christmassy. And I think it is the fact that there's this reward section, because this is the season of candy. The world's really dark. We light it up and make it look like candy. We're aggressively happy. We get this yearly reward in which we indulge or make peace with our enemies. The dog catches the car, finally gets to drive the car around. The holiday season, I've always said, it's about sitting in the back seat of the car, listening to tunes, let the dog drive around for once. That's my personal holiday hallucination. Maria, she's traveled up the sleeve. Let's get back to that, and I'll keep opining about this. But they go to Candy Meadow. They cross through the almond and raisin gate. So crazy. Upon a gallery built over the gate, made apparently of barley sugar, there's 6 apes. They struck up the finest Turkish music which was ever heard, so that Maria scarcely observed that they were walking onward and onward over a rich mosaic, which was nothing else than a pavement of nicely inlaid lozenges. Sweet-smelling woods open up on either side of them.
It's called the Christmas Wood, specifically. Shepherds and hunters show up, and they are so white they seem to be made of sugar, which I assume they are made of sugar, like they're sugar people. They put her on a chair, and then they do a dance for her. Afterwards, the Nutcracker apologizes for their dance. He goes, oh, you know, these guys are a little rusty. They're tightrope walkers. That's what they do. Mm-hmm. And they're just trying to do a regular ground dance. She's like, what are you talking? That was awesome. I loved it. Going crazy for it. And of course, like you said, this is the chapter where we get all of our ballet, you know, because there's a few times people stop and do some dances for her.
In this section, this all reward chapter, you keep seeing conflict try to break out and Maria keeping it cool.
They pass an orange brook and a lemonade river, but they're going to the capital. They get to Gingerbreadville, which is actually situated on a river of molasses. The people there are really grumpy because they all have toothaches. And that explanation raises far more questions than it answers.
Yeah, I think there's a Wendigo situation happening in Gingerbreadville because there's like rampant cannibalism. That's what he's trying to say. But again, there's sort of like, there's problems over there. Let's avoid it.
Yeah. So we get a little world building going on. Paperland trades with this town that has transparent colored buildings called Bonbon Town. The people there are threatened by generals Flying Gnat, and they trade with Paperland and King Chocolate for protection.
Generals Flying Gnat, maybe they're to represent the fae, fairy folk, because they're insects.
Could be.
But the Nutcracker, again, he describes the conflict there, and he says, we're not going to visit all the little towns and villages of the land to the capital. There's still conflict. There's crazy stuff going on, but we're not going to dwell on it. Haven't we had enough of that?
At the beginning of the story, Maria described this little lake that she was hoping Godfather Drosselmeyer was going to build for her. Now, lo and behold, it's there in real life, just as she described it. And she tells the Nutcracker, look, this is what I envisioned. This is what I wanted Godfather Drosselmeyer to make. And he says, Godfather Drosselmeyer could never make anything like this. You yourself, rather, sweet Miss Stahlbaum. But we will not trouble our heads about that. Let us sail across the Rose Lake to the capital. So he's dissing Drosselmeyer.
Or saying that we don't have access to your imagination. We don't have access to the things that you've dreamt of.
Yeah.
Drosselmeyer can't do that. Only you can. You have a unique perspective on the world, that this is the kind of Garden of Eden that only you can create. I mean, she's imbued with this creator-like status.
She is sort of the god of this realm in a way.
Yeah.
So in chapter 13, which is next, we get to the capital. They go to the edge of the Rose Lake, and there is a fancy boat that two golden dolphins pull the boat. And they sing, who sails upon the rosy lake? The little fairy, awake, awake. Music and song, bim, bim, fishes. Sim, sim, swans, tweet, tweet, birds. Whiz, whiz, breezes.
Wow.
It goes on for a while. I'm not going to sing the whole song. That's the golden dolphins. Maria looks down into the water and she sees Perlipat looking up at her. And the Nutcracker says, oh, no, that's not Perlipat. That's you. That's your reflection. And that causes her to blush. The little folks help them out of the boat and onto the shores of Sweetmeat Grove. They make their way to the city gates and the city is called Confectionville. Well, all these folks show up to welcome the Nutcracker and call him Prince. So he's royalty here. They walk in a bit and there's a huge market. Of course, it is filled with lots and lots of candy.
This Adventure Time has this Candyland thing going on all over the place.
Lots of little people show up beautifully dressed. It says Armenians and Greeks, Jews and Tyrolese, officers and soldiers, preachers, shepherds, and harlequins. In short, all the people that could possibly be found in the world.
Just at that moment, the Grand Mogul was carried in by a palanquin, attended by 93 grandees of the kingdom and 700 slaves. Now, on the opposite corner, the fishermen, 500 strong, were marching in procession. And it happened, very unfortunately, that the Grand Turk took it into his head just then to ride over the marketplace with 3,000 Janissaries, besides which a loner train came from the Festival of Sacrifices with sounding music singing, Up and thank the mighty sun, and pushed straight on for the obelisk. Then what a squeezing and a pushing and a rattling and a clattering. By and by, a screaming was heard, for a fisherman had knocked off a Brahmin's head in the crowd, and the great mogul was almost run over by a harlequin. The tumult grew wilder and wilder, and they had commenced to beat and strike each other, when the man in the brocade dressing gown, who had called Nutcracker a prince at the gate, clambered up by the obelisk, and having thrice pulled a little bell, called out three times, Confesseur! Confesseur! Confesseur!
Wow, there's a lot going on in there. That paragraph is pretty dense with crazy things. First of all, there's slavery in Candyland, which is pretty dark. But also,
yeah, there's some Festival of Sacrifices.
Yes, the Festival of Sacrifices? What's that about?
That's the festival that Lovecraft, in his story, The Festival, that's it. It's in this story.
All these people who seem really important decide to descend on this place at the same time, and then they get in a big fight. The dude's head gets knocked off, but the Nutcracker's able to calm everybody down. The great mogul's clothes are cleaned. The Brahmin's head is put back on. She asks why they call him Confesseur, which is French for confectioner. And he says, by confesseur, it is meant an unknown but very fearful power, which they believe can do with them as he pleases. It is the fate that rules over this merry little people, and they fear it so much that the mere mention of the name is able to still the greatest tumult. Each one of them thinks no longer of anything earthly, of cuffs and kicks and broken heads, but retires within himself and says, what are we? And what is our destiny?
Mm-hmm.
Some pretty existential stuff getting thrown out there.
I felt like, per my earlier half-baked analysis, that this section was an example of conflict as something that is inevitable. You know, you see it happen here where there's just a bunch of confusion and it leads to people getting angry, but it can be addressed. The fight broke out due to confusion. It says the tumult was immediately appeased. And this is the world after Maria's ascendance here. I feel like earlier some sausage fat confusion caused a bloody war, had curses, affected the innocent, it lasted forever. When she wasn't in control. A similar kind of confusion breaks out here, and it's able to be smoothed over right away. Now, you are assuming that the Nutcracker did that, which I find very interesting, because it does not say that the Nutcracker did that. It says they commenced to beat and strike each other. The man in a brocade dressing gown who had called Nutcracker a prince at the gate. So they're telling you who he is. Uh-huh. You've seen him before. He'd address the Nutcracker. That's to identify him. Mm-hmm. Clambered up to the obelisk, pulled a bell, and called out, Confesseur, Confesseur, Confesseur. So he's saying this word to the people. Mm-hmm. He's not calling the Nutcracker that. What he is saying is, in the face of cosmic horror,
sure,
why are you doing this to each other?
I see it now, yeah.
And they all go, you're right. This is stupid. The world is crazy. Let's not fight.
Right. When I took it is because Maria asked what it meant. She was asking why they were calling him that, but that's not actually what she says. You're right. She just asks what it means. It doesn't say who they were calling it, and it does make much more sense that she, the godlike entity of this world that she has created, is the one that they are calling the Confesseur.
Well, I don't think they're calling anybody that. I think that he's going, remember, Confesseur, this concept. He's calling out to the concept. What are we and what is our destiny? It's meant an unknown but very fearful power. So it's not a power that anybody has, but it's the power. It's like Krom. It's a god. It's a god that isn't nice.
But isn't she that god? Believe,
no, it's fate. He says the Confesseur is a power that can do with them as they please. It is the fate that rules over these people. They fear it so much that the mere mention of the name of it, a fate, is able to still the greatest tumult. This is awesome because this guy comes up and invokes the idea of cosmic horror as a means of calming conflicts. Like, this comes to nothing.
Yes.
Fate will decide whether you get stricken with illness. Fate will decide whether you die tomorrow. Fate will decide if you live a long life. It's out of your hands, so stop fighting.
I think it definitely could be her. I mean, she is the consumer of candy. She's going to, like, eat all these people. She's the one that designed the little place by the lake and the castle and all of these things.
Well, no, you're right. That's actually true. So maybe I don't think they're calling up to her and calling her that name.
No.
But in the end, is she that fate that they are talking about? Yeah, yeah. You know, you might. They do live in the world of that house, and her whims determine their fate, you know? So yeah, you're totally right. But I think that that's what that's about. And we found, but isn't it cool to find this really crazy Lovecraftian message here?
Oh yeah.
In the middle of it. And then it rings with a positive effect, which is, hey, let's all get along because this stuff is so messed up.
Yeah. Now they walked to the castle, which is called Marzipan Castle. And he tells her how recently Giant Sweet Tooth came by and he was eating on the castle. They gave him a quarter of the city and a bit of Sweetmeat Grove as well. And he ate his fill and then just left.
Negotiated a peace.
Yep.
Again, a solution. Like, maybe you don't need all this stuff. Maybe he was doing that because he was hungry instead of killing him. Mm. ETA Hoffman's got to talk to my D&D group because almost killed a giant just last night. Dude was just walking around.
Oh, poor giant. Now, music starts playing and these little pages come out and they make way presenting. These four little ladies come out, they're the size of dolls, and they call the Nutcracker brother. This brings him to tears of joy to see his sisters. And then he introduces Miss Maria Stahlbaum, the daughter of the much respected and worthy physician, and she is the preserver of my life. Had she not thrown her shoe at the right time, had she not supplied me with the sword of a pensioned colonel, I should now be lying in my grave, torn and bitten to pieces by the terrible Mouse King. View her, gaze upon her, and tell me if Pirlipat, although a princess by birth, can compare with her beauty, goodness, and virtue. No, I say no!
You're like, we weren't arguing with you, man.
So the sisters, they fawn over Maria. They have food brought out. They sit and enjoy a diabetes-inducing meal. Over the meal, the Nutcracker retells the whole story to his sisters, and then Maria passes out. And now Maria was raised up as if mounting waves higher and higher, higher and higher, higher and higher.
Chapter 14, the conclusion.
She then falls and then lands straight in her bed. I guess we can assume that she was asleep. She tries to tell her mother and the doctor, her father, about what happened. They say, oh, you obviously just had a dream. But she insists that it wasn't a dream, that it was all real. And her mom is starting to get angry with her. But Maria says, I have proof. What I'm telling you is true. Mm-hmm. So she runs over. She gets the tiny seven crowns of the Mouse King that the Nutcracker gave her after his victory. They look at them and they're astonished by these. They go, wow, these are so detailed. And they're so small that they must not have been able to be crafted by a human hand.
It's evidence from the dream world. Ding, 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 ding,
ding.
I was very happy this happened. I predicted it, yes.
Godfather Drosselmeyer shows up just then, right at the proper moment, and he explains, oh, no, no, I made those for Maria when she was 2 years old. I doubt she remembers that. Now, Maria starts to get angry, and she says, no, that is not true. And she says that Drosselmeyer knows the true story, and he's lying. And he gets angry with her in return, and he says, stupid pack, I don't know what that means.
That was what when he started sort of like malfunctioning and glitching earlier in the story, you know, when she said she'd had this fantasy.
Yeah.
He was saying that then too, right?
Yeah. So I don't know what that means exactly. Maybe it's a translation issue. The doctor, her father, takes her on his knee and says, all the storytelling must stop. You must quit lying. And if you don't, I'm going to start throwing your toys out the window. And I thought, oh, the injustice of it all. So awful. Even her brother, who was totally a true believer previously, he turns on her and says, oh, no, you're making up stuff. That's crazy. She's like, but you gave me the sword and did the stuff. And at that, she gives up.
This might have been the kind of thing that made people ask whether the story was suitable for children or not. Because if you think about the end of Wizard of Oz, it was all a dream and you were there and you were there and you were there. But you could tell she's carrying in her heart that there was some reality to it. And nobody dispels that. Nobody in her family says, shut up, never talk about that again. This is Kansas. We're normal people here, you freak. But that's what happens here. We're going to take your toys away. Don't talk about that. It's all nonsense. Well, that makes it more of a children's story to me because that mirrors the real experience of childhood, doesn't it? That you at some point will get in trouble for having a fantasy world, or people will smother dreams if they seem like they're odd in some way. Or,
yeah. You know. I hope never to be that parent. Yeah, I will wait and see. Maybe my kid will start saying some crazy stuff about seven-headed mouse. We're getting to the end here. Some time has passed, and Godfather Drosselmeyer is at the house fixing one of her father's clocks, and she casually says, while looking at the Nutcracker, and Drosselmeyer is an earshot of this, she says, ah, dear Master Drosselmeyer, if you actually were living, I would not behave like Princess Pirlipat and slight you, because for my sake you had ceased to be a handsome young man. At this, the counselor screamed, that's Drosselmeyer, he screams, hey, hey, stupid pack! Then there was a clap and a knock so loud that Maria sank from her chair in a swoon. Did he hit her?
I don't think she would have sank from her chair in a swoon if she was punched. That's typically not how you describe it. I was wondering why you thought that.
But there's a clap and a knock.
Mm-hmm.
And then she comes to, her mother's there, and asks, how did you fall out of your chair?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I thought, he hit her. Like, he's angry with her for some reason.
I thought that there was a giant cracking noise or a clap or something that sounded like that because it was the Nutcracker coming to life. It was the sound of the magic, and that would sound like a wood exploding or something. So I thought there might be, you know, that's what. But I think that was the sound of magic, not abuse.
Because the Nutcracker, I would
join us on our fun on our forthcoming series, magic or abuse.
I could be totally reading it wrong. I mean, I read it to you. That's what it said there. So I don't know exactly what's going on. Because things get nutty after this point.
Well, yeah. But I mean, I felt like she showed a pure heart. It allowed the Nutcracker to turn into a real little boy. That was the last thing she needed to do. And I felt that that was a triumph in the face of people resisting the reality of what had happened, telling her it was all a dream.
But why does that happen after he says, hey, hey, stupid pack? Like, I feel like she would have said that. Then there would be a clap and a knock. So loud that she changed, and then he would say, hey, hey, stupid pack, and then she would pass out. But it feels like I see what you're saying.
I think it's
probably
his, like,
wrong.
Clock-like, weird nature that he's this odd, you know, he just malfunctions in that moment, is what I felt like. Just like when she told that there's a crossover, there's like a bridge between this fantasy world and the real world, and every time she bridges it, he malfunctions, you know? And so it happened earlier when she said, I saw this stuff happen, and he went, and then he started telling her the story. And in this moment, despite the fact that he and her parents have said none of that happened, she comes up to the Nutcracker and says, I know it happened, and I'll tell you what, if you were... In spite of what they said, if you were living, I wouldn't act like that. I'd marry you even though you're ugly because I know that you're a good person at heart, which is what was needed to...
Right.
It happens. And then he's at the door.
And, of course, I have got on my dark specs. You know, like, I'm a horror... Mm-hmm. We do a horror, basically, podcast, so I'm looking for the darkness in these things as well.
Sure. And everything's on the table with Hoffman, so you know. It's, you got people plucking eyes out of kids and feeding them to owl babies and stuff. So, yeah, I get it.
But her mom gets her up and says Drosselmeyer's nephew has just shown up at the house. Mm-hmm. He's there. He's white as milk and red as blood, which I don't quite understand what that means. I guess he's pale, but also has, I mean, a pink.
He's,
I would think
he's
pink.
Got fair, fair, noble skin, but he's full of life. I think the red as blood is to let you know it's a living human thing.
Got it. Okay.
You know, the baby was described that way, Pris Perlipat.
Right.
So it's like he's absorbed her beauty and not her ugliness.
Yeah.
The beauty that she shouldn't have, he's got.
Now, he's done up in a fancy military uniform with a bejeweled sword. He brought Maria some gingerbread and some sugar figurines as replacements for the things that she lost when she had to give them up to the Mouse King. Everyone is gathered around, and he starts cracking nuts with his mouth, and everybody's totally jazzed to be eating these cracked nuts that this guy just had in his mouth. In his mouth. He's the life of the party. Can you imagine having somebody come over to your house and like, hey, check this out. It just cracks nuts with his mouth and then hands out. And people are,
I mean, I'm imagining it now that you put it that way. Yeah.
The nephew then asks Maria to go into the room where the nutcracker display case is. And Drosselmeyer says, play prettily together, children. I have nothing against it, since all my clocks are going. When they get into the room, this happens.
Scarcely was Maria alone with young Drosselmeyer when he stooped upon one knee and said, oh, my very best Miss Stahlbaum, you see here at your feet the happy Drosselmeyer, whose life you saved on this very spot. You said most amiably that you would not slight me like the hateful Princess Pirlipat if I had become ugly for your sake. From that moment, I ceased to be a miserable nutcracker and resumed again my old, and I hope not disagreeable, figure. Oh, excellent Miss Stahlbaum, make me happy with your dear hand. Share with me crown and kingdom. Rule with me in Marchpane Castle, for there I am still king. Maria raised the youth and said softly, dear Master Drosselmeyer, you are a kind, good-natured young man, and since you rule in such a charming land, among such pretty, merry people, I will be your bride. With this, Maria immediately became Drosselmeyer's betrothed bride. After a year and a day, he came, as I have heard, and carried her away in a golden chariot drawn by silver horses. There danced at the wedding 22,000 of the most splendid figures, adorned with pearls and diamonds. And Maria, it is said, is at this hour queen of a land where sparkling Christmas woods, transparent Marchpane castles, in short, where the most beautiful, the most wonderful things can be seen by those who will only have eyes for them.
That's the end of the story.
Bam! That's the end of the Nutcracker and the Mouse King. I liked that ending where he says, the most beautiful, the most wonderful things can be seen by those who will only have eyes for them. To me, that resonated with some of this theme that I've been drawing out of here, which is a conflict-free world is possible, but we tell ourselves the story that it's not.
Mm-hmm.
She sees it, and that's her value prop. You know, that's the thing that she's got over everybody else, is that she's not accepting the story that's being told to her. When her parents tell her that that stuff's not real, she doesn't believe it. And that's what you have to do to affect change in the world, is believe in those stories and stop listening to the conventional stuff. So many things in life are about the stories we tell ourselves. I'm not good at this. I can't do that. They're just stories. Yeah. And if you believe in another story, those things can manifest. And I feel like this is Maria. This is the point that's kind of being driven home here, is that under the guise of someone who does believe that it's possible, it can happen. Is that crazy?
I think that's a beautiful way to take the story. I have a much darker end to it. I think that she died, and this is her idea of heaven. And this is what she wanted.
Did you think she died at the hands of Drosselmeyer?
I do.
That it ended with a murder?
I do.
Why wasn't that in the ballet?
It should have been.
I would have liked a little twist at the end, you know?
Of course, I could be wrong, but it just, it becomes so unreal after she is hit, I guess, is what I keep thinking that is, that the crack. This guy shows up who has to be at least 15, if not older. He's an older guy, and she's like 7 years old. He's not going to go in and marry a 7-year-old kid. This is all from her perspective.
Well, they go into the, this is the fantasy land is manifest.
Yeah, exactly.
Because of, yeah.
But the, for this fantasy land to manifest, this is like a whole other world. It seems like she's finally getting everything that she wants. But the only way for that to happen is for her to not be around anymore, because that's not the real world.
Yes, that's right.
Like, if you want to look at it in a really dark way, that in death she finds ascendance.
But, you know, the key phrase there was, if you want to look at it in a really dark way.
I couldn't help it. That's where my mind went to.
You know, you're like watching Scooby-Doo and going, where are their parents? I mean, if you want to look at this in a really dark way, this is a bunch of 16-year-olds living in a van, terrorized constantly. But no, I hear you, dude. I hear you. Well, I think that that's on purpose. Yeah. The adults are menacing in this, and they don't ever prove to be any better than that.
No.
At the end, they tell her no to all of her dreams. Why do that? She's a kid.
Yeah, she's 7. Just say, yeah, go for it.
I feel like she had dreams of a better place, and despite the oppression of the elders, she held to her beliefs and as a result made them manifest in the real world. That's how I feel.
Yeah. And I think that's what is intended, because it was written for children. But then again, E.T.A. Hoffman, he's got some dark stuff going on. So he might have put this all in there, that this undercurrent that I'm catching. Mm-hmm. Intentionally just going, well, you know, if you want to creep it up a bit, it's in there.
Yeah, I agree. The story's a bit of a candy cigarette, you know? It's like, it's pretty sweet, but wait a minute, what is the shape of this thing really? Because it's, you know, there's... The kids are just going to see this, the dancing and the ballet and the fun, but yeah. The adults are reading between the lines and going, there's... If you want to look at this in the dark way, which we do because we're grown-ups, it's there for us. So yeah. I think we said that right away. There's stuff in here for the grown-ups.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And yeah. This is brilliant. This story, I was so glad that we did The Nutcracker. I never would have given it the time of day, honestly, until I had read... I didn't even know E.T.A. Hoffman wrote it originally. I thought it was a Dumas thing, and I just was like, little dancing people with candy lands and stuff. I'm like, I don't want to read that. Who's got time for that stuff? But now, whoa.
Oh, man, yeah. I think I associated part of the suite with like a jewelry commercial or something, you know, because these things get played so much.
Yeah.
So this is my first year really appreciating it for sure.
I want to thank Andrew Lehman for reading this thing like a champion.
As always, he's the one that's got the magic. Sometimes I wonder, did he just do magic, or did he just hit me? It's that powerful.
And I want to thank some of our patron as well. Firstly, Red Biologist, thank you.
Thank you so much. I want to thank Stephen Wall.
I'd like to thank Warwick Davey.
I'd like to thank Anthony Barone.
Jane Richards, thank you.
Vlad Dracul, I'd like to thank. That's... pretty close to Dracula, but I'll let it fly. I doubt that's Dracula.
Isn't Dracul the dragon, and Dracula is the son of the dragon?
Oh, that's Dracula's dad.
Yeah, got real, dude. I want to thank Kyle Jordan.
I want to thank Brian Millett.
I'd like to thank Sean Bedell.
And Kate B. Thank you so much. We're not actually sure at this point what we're doing in January, but I think it's going to be some good mythos short stories. We're going to swing hard back around into the weird fiction pulp territory.
Yeah.
Potpourri of stories is what I'm looking for, because... we got werewolves and Draculas to get into in the new year.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I'm hoping. I'm going to plant this seed in your ear right now, Pfeiffer.
Mm-hmm.
I Am Legend for March. Just saying.
March is for Draculas. I Am Legend.
Just think about it. Just think about it.
We'll have to see what the folks out there think.
I want to hear what people think, if they think that would be a good thing to cover, because I love that book.
Well, cool. Well, Happy New Year, everybody. We've got a comment show still coming out yet this December, but yeah. That'll be it for us yakking about stories until 2022.
Oh, boy. I want everybody to have a wonderful new year. Hopefully 2022 will be a better one and all your dreams will come true.
Just be like the fourth section of the Nutcracker and party it out until then. And we'll be joining you again then. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories
here at HPPodcraft.com and Patreon.